Well, today we're going to look at state-level unemployment data and the health of the jobs market and a number of other things that we're looking at. We're going to have a number of charts that we're going to be featuring at Financial Sense. If you're listening on the go in your car, don't worry about it. We're not going to get too much in the weeds. But if you do want to check out all these charts and data that we're going to be discussing, they will be posted on financialsense.com. And joining us today for our Smart Macro program, as always, is our Chief Investment Officer here at Financial Sense Wealth Management, Chris Poplava. So Chris, we were just talking with the original founder of PayPal, CEO of PayPal, also prior CEO of Intuit and TurboTax on our show. That's going to be airing on Monday. But we were talking with him. He's also a listener of the show as well. And he was talking about, you know, how people are still moving aggressively out of these high tax states. That's going to continue. California's raising taxes. A lot of these other states that have big budget deficits, they're going to be raising taxes. So the move continues, and you've been drilling down into the state level data when it comes to unemployment levels. California's ticking up, but also in the aggregate picture, of course. And again, these charts we're going to have posted so you can take a look at that. But tell us what we're seeing and how this differs from what the official government numbers are telling us.
When we last spoke, this was the week prior to the most recent jobs report for February from the government, from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And what they showed it, Chris, was that for the last 3 months, we have had over 200,000 jobs growth in since December. So December was 290, January is 229, and in February we saw a growth of 275,000 new jobs. Now, this flies in the face, Chris, of virtually every other labor statistic data point. For example, you look at the household survey, three straight months of job losses. I'm talking no growth. In December, we saw a loss of 683,000 jobs. January was a loss of 31,000. And for February, we saw a loss of 184,000 jobs. I mean, these two reports could not be more polar opposite from each other. So there is clearly a disconnect from the models-based non-farm payrolls, which obviously has the proverbial birth-death model, versus the household survey where the government's actually picking up the phone and calling people. And we really see a divergence, Chris, starting in November. So for example, when we look at the cumulative job growth since November, the non-farm payroll report shows a growth of 794,000 jobs. You look at the household survey, we've lost nearly 1.5 million jobs. We're talking a 2.3 million job discrepancy just since November. I mean, there's a major discrepancy in the data here, Chris. And what we've noticed is it's the non-farm payrolls that get revised down closer to reflect what we see in the household survey versus the household survey getting revised up. So that's a huge problem, Chris. And to me, it definitely makes it appear as though the economy is running into trouble here, especially as we got into to close out 2023. You know, these are charts, again, as you mentioned, we'll have available. But when we look at the last year, year and a half, and we look at just the trajectory of the normalized job growth in household versus the non-farm payroll report, they were more or less tracking each other. That was obviously the household survey is going to have a little bit more volatility in it. But it really appears as if the lights went out on job growth in November, and that's where we saw this peak. And the other thing, Chris, I took a look at was looking at it on a six-month basis. So when I look at the last 6 months and look at the net change, what I'm seeing is a huge divergence between, again, the non-farm payroll report versus the household survey, where the household survey over the last 6 months has seen a loss of 1 million jobs, well, the BLS survey has seen a gain of 1.4. Now, I'm looking at a 6 month because that's really roughly give or take when I really saw things change. And I wanted to look back historically and see if that level is significant. And when we look back, Chris, all the way to the early to mid 1990s, the only other time we saw a loss of more than 1 million jobs over a 6 month period was in late 95, 96. That was really brief. And then there was a big pickup in the household survey. And then it turned dramatically positive going to 96, 97. So it did turn negative about the same extent as where we are now, but it was only for a month or two. So unless we snap back, this would be a major change in character where this is recessionary territory. I mean, this was the Tails 1-2 recession. We were already deep in recession at this point. Roughly around this time, we were nearing the end of 2008, the financial crisis and recession, and when we were at a comparable level. So these are extreme. I mean, these aren't even yellow flags. These are red flags. I mean, these are really disconcerting when you think of where they are and where the economy is.
One thing I'm wondering here is because a lot of strategists talk about and watch initial jobless claims as a very real-time weekly measure of the health of the job market. Because, of course, when people are fired or laid off, you're going to see that reflected eventually in whether or not people are claiming unemployment benefits during that point in time. And so that's something that's very widely watched. We're not seeing that in the initial jobless claim. So what do you think is happening here?
You know, I think Chris Anna Wong, the chief economist of Bloomberg, who you have on the podcast periodically, I think she nailed it. And what she brought up was the fact that you tend to see this when you have back-to-back recessions or recessions that are very close to each other. So with the prolonged recession in with 2020, now again, 2020 wasn't a long recession. It was very short. However, the unemployment rate stayed elevated for some time. And so you had a massive amount of the population go on unemployment and use their unemployment benefits. And so they're not eligible for filing for unemployment again because they basically exhausted their benefits and they needed to pay into the system to be able to draw on it again. So they're not eligible. So there's a real issue with eligibility versus when you look at the prior recessions, usually you would have even as much as 10 years between recessions. You know, the 90, 91, then you had the 2001, and then you had the 2007 and 8. So, you know, you had well more than a 5-year gap between the two. And the duration of unemployment wasn't really as long as what we were dealing with kind of transitioning out of lockdowns and COVID. So that was a problem. And then the other thing is the creation of the gig economy. So even if you are eligible for unemployment benefits, those benefits are typically a fraction of what you were earning previously before you were laid off. And what Anna's pointing out is a lot of change of looking at, do I want to file for unemployment or do I want to get in my car and be an Uber driver, Lyft driver, or Uber Eats or DoorDash and these kind of things. And so there's a big pickup in the amount of people that are basically in the gig economy where they can make more money than just sitting at home and filing for unemployment. So that's part of the reason why you're not seeing this pickup in jobless claims, and yet the unemployment rate is picking up. So it was really perplexing people. And I really think that Anna nailed it in terms of looking at eligibility for filing again after being unemployed during COVID, as well as the transition to basically kind of thinking out, you know, what are you better off doing? You know, basically getting in your car and being an Uber or Lyft driver or sitting at home and filing for unemployment.
Yeah. And I had sent that chart that you had posted and that we discussed earlier this year about the number of states that are seeing rising unemployment and that is registering a recessionary signal to Anna Wong and asked her thoughts. And, you know, she basically says that it shows that we're seeing a cooling in the job market here on an aggregate national level. And just recently, Jeff Gundlach picked up this data as well, and he was pointing to it as a little bit of a red flag here. What was the point that he made about this data that you thought was really important?
So he kind of did the same thing, you know, what percent of states have rising unemployment? And his point was that those states like Montana, Wyoming, these are low population states that did not have rising unemployment. Given their low population, if you did a weighted population average, then we're probably closer to 95, 98% of the country is seeing rising unemployment. So it's pretty much universal, except for some very low population states. And again, you know, the lower the population, the less those states are kind of adding to the national economic growth. So it's a really concerning picture. And one of the things I was really looking forward to, Chris, was to get the employment data for February, but the state data comes out with a lag. So what I wanted to see was the January data that we would get, and it deteriorated, Chris, pretty much across the board. The percent of states with a rising unemployment above their 12-month average, that rose to 86%. And what I've seen historically going back to the late 1970s is we've never seen anything above 60% not being associated with a recession. So I would kind of call that DEFCON 3. And when I look at the two-year average, percent of states where the unemployment's above their two-year average, that stayed constant at 75%. So that didn't change. But we've never seen it above 50% outside of a recession. So now that would, to me, would say we're in DEFCON 2, that the two-year is above that 50%, you know, threshold. And when I look at the percent of states above their three-year average, that rose, Chris, to 27% and sharply rising. And historically, looking at things, we've never really been above 30% outside of a recession. So, you know, we'll discuss this in another month, and then we'll have the February data. But if we get above that 30% threshold, that's DEFCON 1. I mean, we've got the 1, 2, and 3 are all above their thresholds that flag a recession. And that would strongly argue the U.S. economy is seeing deterioration and we are likely in a recession. We just don't know it yet because the government data, especially the massaged model data, is so inaccurate and giving a false signal. That would be a huge concern. And further, Chris, you know, I really slice and dice the data because I take a weighted, you know, average approach. And it's not just one indicator. It's when I look at the whole employment cycle, and I've discussed this before, so I won't go into it again for our listeners, but in terms of the progression of what you see small businesses and large businesses do, I'm seeing further signs that we're in recession. A good example of this is full-time employment. I took a look at the percent drawdown of full-time employment payrolls, and currently we're at about we're down about 1.4%. And again, outside of a blip in 94-95, this is recessionary territory. And what's concerning is, again, no sign of a turnaround. This continues to fall month after month. So the fact that we're in recessionary territory in terms of the drawdown from full-time employment, that's a concern for me. And when I look at temporary services, that too is we're down almost 14% off the highs. We don't have as long of a history, but that goes back to the early 90s. So we can see what it did in the 01 and the 08 recessions. And then obviously COVID, which, you know, to me was a one-off event. But outside of that, I mean, a nearly 14% drawdown from the peak in temp employment, that tells me, Chris, that employers are cutting staff wherever they can. The easiest, again, is always temp, and then you cut your full-time, and then eventually you just lay off your workers altogether versus just cutting hours. So that's a huge concern, seeing the significant drawdown from temporary payrolls as well as full-time payrolls.
Well, and you said that if you look at this employment data and whether or not that is the drawdown in payrolls for full employment, if you look at temp employment, if you look at the state data, rising unemployment levels, you look at all of these various measures that are saying that we're in a recession or maybe close to it, you know, I do want to point out that even if that seems like a low odd scenario for people listening, let's point out that the manufacturing part of the economy is in a recession, and it has been in a recession ever since 2022. I mean, it started moving into contraction territory back in 2022. It's been under 50, contracting all of 2023, and it still is for 2024. So if you're in the manufacturing sector, you are experiencing a recession. It's the services part, which is why this data is so important, right?
That's correct, Chris. I mean, what dominates the economy is the service sector. So, you know, we've been in a manufacturing recession for well over a year now, I would say pretty much 2 years. And yet that has not spilled over to the rest of the economy or an overall outright recession. Because again, as long as we're growing jobs, then the service side of the economy was strong. Now, this is starting to come into question, Chris, with the data that I was just showing in terms of the employment situation. When you basically, if you look at anything other than the non-farm payroll report, there's a lot of concern. And what's interesting, Chris, is we're not yet seeing that being realized by the market. But in general, the market really, Chris, honestly doesn't care about the economy until it's basically looking at a recession right in the eyes. And the way to see that is usually the S&P rolls over when jobless claims start to pick up, because that's when the market is like, okay, we've got a situation on our hands. But what the market is keying in on is the non-farm payrolls, which look good. Again, I think they're incorrect. And secondly, jobless claims, which still look calm, which again, I think is given a false signal, as Anna Wong was highlighting. So I think there's this disconnect with the market and the economy, mainly because the market is keying in on two economic data points that, to me, Chris, have very little validity in terms of being supported by other data. So the risk is, one, the economy needs to turn around in quick, or the market could reconnect with the economy and start to decline. And is, you know, what we are seeing some people highlight improving breath measures, Chris, in terms of saying the market is broadening out. And that would give hope that the economy is stabilizing and doing well and weathered the Fed rate hikes and we'll have that proverbial soft landing. But again, Chris, when you dig beneath the surface, I don't think that's the case.
Yeah, and you have a couple charts here where you're pointing out the percent of members that are above their 200-day moving average. So this is a breadth measure for the Russell 3000. And then you also have this for the S&P 500. So let's talk about what you're seeing under the surface in terms of market breadth.
So we are seeing some pretty strong breadth when it comes to large cap stocks, and that's as measured by the S&P 500. So with the S&P, we're looking at 500 large cap stocks and the percent above their 200-day moving average. And that, basically the 200-day is kind of almost like a one-year trading average, or basically how is it over the last 1 year. And you want to see a really high number to signify a strong market. And we actually see that. Right now, we're at about 78% of those 500 companies are above their long-term average. That's a very strong, healthy number. That's about the numbers we saw back in 2021. So these are strong numbers. The concern was on a shorter-term time frame where the percent above their 50-day was starting to diverge from the market. While the market was going up, it was going down. That changed in February, where it started to pick back up again. It's about 73% now. That's still off when in late December, early January, are north of 90%. So there is a bit of a divergence there. There's fewer stocks above their shorter term average compared to several months ago. But Chris, I think the problem is when we kind of look beyond large cap, we're seeing a different story. And as you mentioned, the Russell 3000, that's 3,000 stocks. So that's the Russell 2000 small cap index, where you're looking at 2,000 small cap stocks and you're looking at 1,000 large cap. So that's a huge sample size. I believe that's about 98% of the entire US market capitalization. So that's basically the market. And when we look at that, we see a different picture. We're not looking at 500, we're looking at six times the number of companies in the Russell 3000. And you know, again, back in December, there was about 90% of members were above their 50-day moving average. That was more or less in line with the S&P 500. That was solid. That was strong. Chris, today we're at 49%. So we're less than half of stocks are above their 50-day. And when we look at the 200-day, you want to see that north of 70%, a nice solid number. We're at 59% and declining. That peaked at around 70% 3 months ago. That's at 59% and falling. So it's not keeping up with the market. It's not what we're seeing with the large cap indices. And it does mean that this market is getting more and more selective. Now, again, that Russell 3000, that has 2,000 small cap. When we strip out those large cap 1,000 members, we look just at the 2,000 small cap. We're looking at the Russell 2000. That, Chris, really presents a concerning picture. And to me, what it's representing is that small cap companies are having a hard time with these high interest rates, because they don't have the financing and strength of the large cap companies that have very strong cash flow to support their businesses. They can tap the equity markets, and given their strength, when they do need to tap the debt markets, usually they're doing so at lower yields than, let's say, a small cap company with more risk. And when we look at the Russell 2000, again, looking back in December, things look pretty good. About 90% were above their 50-day moving average. But where we look at it today, Chris, that stands at 41%. So again, you look at the S&P 500, 73% of stocks are above their 50-day average. That falls to 41% for the Russell. What is more concerning, and you know, you want to look at that 200-day average, that's kind of your primary trend that really helps to delineate bull or bear market. When we look at the S&P, 78% are above their long-term average. That's really good. That's healthy. That's what you want to see in a bull market. The Russell 2000, it's down to 52%. It's almost a coin toss where you have half of stocks in a bull market, half of them are in a bear market. So that is a concern, and it does kind of put into question how strong of an advance we can see in the market when a good portion of it is not participating. So it does to me, Chris. And again, when I'm looking at the jobs market, small businesses, the sentiment from small businesses, the falling consumer sentiment, what I see, Chris, is essentially capital is going into a fewer and fewer number of names, which is driving up the large cap index like the Dow or the S&P, which is really everyone's focus, right? You don't really see the financial press talk about the small cap indices. They're usually looking at the big cap companies, the names that people know. But when you look outside of that, I could honestly say, what bull market? I mean, you look at the Russell, I believe it's off, you know, almost 10-15% off of its highs. It still has not eclipsed its high seen in 2021. So there's no bull market when you look at small caps. You look at even mid caps, I think they're barely above their former highs. So if anything, you could just say for mid caps, we're in a trading range, but I would still say small caps are in corrective mode. And based on the data that I'm seeing, small caps, Chris, actually the index looks worse than it is. There's still some members in there that have appreciated dramatically. There's two members, the biggest two weights in the Russell 2000 have market caps north of 50 billion. So these have benefited from AI and Bitcoin that have just gone through the roof. So those are going to be leaving, I believe, in the next couple of months. And when you strip those out, the Russell 2000, the index itself looks even worse than what it does right now when you take that influence of those mega cap, large cap companies out of there.
Well, and another theme that we've been discussing here for quite a while is the fact that it looks like a lot of the inflationary data is putting in a trough around that 3% level. And you have been discussing on our show here now for many months about how leading indicators for inflation are picking up and show that we could be getting back to around the 3.5 or 4% range, perhaps, if they continue on this trend. What's your assessment of the inflation picture currently?
Well, one of the big things that's drawing inflation down, or at least cooling it, is owner's equivalent rent. And it's a flawed metric, but it more or less follows housing prices, Chris, with about an 18-month lag or so. And the fall in home prices or decline has helped to bring down owner's equivalent rent, which is, I think, a third of the entire CPI. But outside of that, you're seeing a lot of stabilization in prices, if not rising. One of the inflation metrics that Jeff Gundlach takes a look at is the import-export inflation. He likes that because we don't have all the hedonic adjustments and things that we've made to the CPI over the years. So it's more or less constant. And you look at the year-over-year rate for the import index, and the year-over-year is at negative 0.8. That's significant, Chris, because it bottomed last year at around a negative, let's say, 6% rate. And if that turns positive, that is not what we want to see. That's going to be adding to inflation. We look at the export index, there too, we're seeing some moderation of disinflation. So that bottomed at around 12% deflation rate last June. That now is at negative 1.8 and rising. So clearly the deflationary pressures that were pulling overall inflation trends down appear to be moderating. And that's why you're starting to see Fed rate cuts being pushed out further and further. So the Fed's going to have a really tough go at it, Chris, if inflation begins to rise at the same time the economy starts to roll over. So if I'm correct, we're heading into recession when inflation remains elevated. What that means is that the Fed will probably be delayed in giving the rate cuts the economy needs. And that's one of the biggest defining things to determine whether a soft land or hard landing is how proactive the Fed is in aggressive with rate cuts. If the Fed is delayed, the ability to stave off a recession and navigate a soft landing really starts to decline. So I think, honestly, Chris, we should be keeping our eye on gold. That could be what gold is sniffing out, is stagflation, you know, moderating economy, yet rising inflation. So gold will be a real key barometer, I think, of Fed policy.
Well, Chris, boil all this down for us. When you think about the technical outlook, as you mentioned, with breadth measures deteriorating currently and some of these economic data points that you're looking at with the unemployment picture. Again, we're going to have a lot of these charts posted on financialsense.com, so you can take a look at those. You know, you're the chief investment officer here at Financial Sense Wealth Management. What are you doing for clients? What are some of the big moves that you're doing right now?
Well, Chris, key point, this is an election year. Politics weigh into things. And there's two measures that I'm keeping a very close eye on that we really hadn't had to pay attention to in prior cycles, and that's a very sizable still reverse repo facility of, I believe it's around $500 billion. We've never seen that before going into recession. I mean, that was basically a zero value. And the Treasury cash account at the Fed, that's around $800 billion. We've never seen that high prior to a recession. So, you know, these factors could kind of get injected into the economy, financial markets to keep things chugging along going to an election year. So we may limp around here based on some of these supports, at least financially, looking at the financial markets, the injections from the reverse repo facility plus the Fed's Treasury program or the Treasury's cash at the Fed. These injections could keep liquidity ample and keep markets afloat. So, you know, absent those supports, Chris, I think we'd be a lot more bearish and defensive for clients. But we do have to be mindful that those are there and the market can really continue to concentrate in large cap. And that's where the performance could be. And that's usually where most benchmarks are benchmarked against on the equity side is the large cap. So, you know, if the large caps keep performing well, you know, we got to stay in there until we really see some deterioration in the large caps. And as I mentioned right now, Chris, 78% of the S&P is above its 200 moving average. That's really strong. So typically you see a lot more deterioration prior to a market top. For example, when we look at the late 21, early 22 peak, the market was at around 75% above their 200 moving average and falling, when a few months prior was around in the 80s. So it's still a decent level. You know, I'd be concerned of a top, we kind of get below the 70 and 60% levels like we see in the mid cap and small cap, but we're not there yet. So I think the market can squeeze out a little bit more, but we definitely are, you know, in terms of that DEFCON analogy, we're on high alert to a, you know, possible threat to our portfolios if the market rolls over here. So we're not sanguine by any means. We're very, we're staying vigilant, looking at the economic data, the market data, to kind of really hone in on, okay, when are things starting to turn that we need to head to the exit? So it's a stressful period, you know, because again, the market to me, Chris, is defining what I'm seeing economically. And so that definitely makes it a tricky environment to navigate.
So as you've said on our program in the past, you know, we're still invested in the stock market, but having a much more of a balanced risk neutral position, not overly exposed to the tech sector, for example, not overly exposed just in cash. So much more in that neutral balanced position currently with exercising some tight risk management, given some of the risks that you outlined today.
That's correct, Chris. You know, we've been fortunate enough to have some really strong performers this year, you know, riding the AI Bitcoin wave. And we've been taking some money off the table because it can reverse. And when it does, it can reverse violently. So, you know, we have benefited from that. We're taking some money off the table, trying to be conservative and make sure that, you know, we keep those gains. But again, I would say my eye remains on the exits. And it's a high stress environment where, you know, we don't have a universal bullish picture for the economy and the financial markets. They're at odds with each other, which definitely makes being vigilant all the more important.
Well, once again, we've been speaking with Financial Sense Wealth Management CIO Chris Poplava. And again, Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. So if you want to reach out, see how we can help you with our comprehensive financial planning or asset management services, just give us a call at 888-486-3939. Once again, that number is 888-486-3939. And again, this is our Smart Macro segment where we speak with Chris Poplava. Look forward to having you on the show in another 2 weeks, Chris.
Look forward to it, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.